Welcome to The Free Will Show, a podcast that provides a beginner-friendly introduction to free will while also exploring cutting-edge developments on the topic. I'm Taylor Sear.
And I'm Matt Plummer. In this episode, we continue our discussion of incompatibilist views. We've been looking at libertarianism, according to which we have free will. But today we discuss free will skepticism, the view that no one has the control necessary for moral responsibility in the basic desert sense.
Our guest is Greg Caruso, and as always, if you have questions for us, you can submit them via our website, thefreewillshow.com, or through social media, at The Free Will Show. Thanks for listening. I'm happy to introduce Greg Caruso, professor of philosophy at SUNY Corning, and honorary professor of philosophy at Macquarie University, and co-director of the Justice Without Retribution Network at the University of Aberdeen School of Law. Greg has written extensively on free will and moral responsibility, including a recent book called Just Deserts, Debating Free Will, which is a debate with Daniel Dennett. His next book is forthcoming with Cambridge University Press, and it's called Rejecting Retributivism, Free Will, Punishment, and Criminal Justice. Greg is also the author of the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy entry on skepticism about moral responsibility, which I'm sure will come up later in this interview. So welcome to the show, Greg. Can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself, your work, and how you came to be interested in working on free will?
Yeah. First, let me just say thank you for having me on. It's a great show, and the first season is something that everyone interested in free will should check out if they haven't already listened to all those episodes.
Oh, thanks.
I
work primarily on issues related to free will, responsibility, and by that I mean both moral and legal responsibility, punishment, philosophy of law, but particularly focused on normative jurisprudence, things having to do with justifications of punishment. And I guess my interest in free will goes back to graduate school, as with many. But ironically, I never took a class on free will or moral responsibility. I did my PhD at the CUNY Graduate Center, which is in New York. And at the time, there really weren't any faculty members working on free will. That may have changed now, but it was heavy on philosophy of mind, cognitive science, philosophy of language. So I was primarily interested in issues of consciousness and cog-sci. But then I did a reading group with a few other graduate students where we went through the first edition of Robert Caine's Oxford Handbook on Free Will. Mm-hmm. And we went chapter by chapter, week to week, one of us would lead the discussion. And that was an education and a learning experience. And it really, kickstarted my interest in free will. So I ended up writing my dissertation by combining my interest. And so I wrote it on free will and consciousness, which eventually became my first book, which is titled Free Will and Consciousness. But since then, I've just continued down the rabbit hole. I thought maybe I'd only work on issues related to free will for a couple of years and maybe move on to something else. And I just never seem to move on. So, it's a complex problem with a number of different applications and overlaps with almost every area of philosophy, metaphysics, agency, ethics, moral philosophy, social and political. And so I've just, explored all the different avenues over time. And now I'm primarily interested in issues having to do with public policy and punishment and criminal justice, which I'm sure we'll talk about later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, to get started, free will skeptics deny that we have free will. So maybe we should start by asking you what you take free will to be.
Yeah. So I define free will in terms of the control and action that's required for a particular type of moral responsibility, which is generally in the literature called basic desert moral responsibility. So Dirk Pirrabhum was maybe one of the first to kind of use this phrase of basic desert. So for him, for an agent to be morally responsible for an action in this basic desert sense is for it to be the agents in such a way that they would either deserve to be praised or blamed if they understood the moral nature of the act. But the desert at issue would be basic in the sense that the agent would deserve to be blamed or praised just because they performed the action, but not for consequentialist or, say, contractualist reasons. So understood in this way, free will is a kind of power or ability an agent has to possess in order to justify certain types of basically deserved judgments, attitudes, and treatments, things like resentment, indignation, moral anger, retributive punishment. And it would be in response to decisions or actions the agent performed or failed to perform. But the key part is that these reactions would be justified on purely backward-looking grounds. That's what makes them basic. And without appeal to consequentialist or forward-looking considerations like future protection or future reconciliation or future moral formation. And I don't know if you want me to say a little bit about why I think that's the right definition, but that's essentially why I define free will in terms of moral responsibility, and in particular in terms of the control and action required for basic desert.
Yeah, that's great. We in the first season, we talked a lot about free will in the sense of having the ability to do otherwise, and why maybe God's foreknowledge or causal determinism would rule out those things. But we also saw that a lot of people are taking free will to just be this condition on moral responsibility, the control condition on responsibility. So we've come across that already.
And if I could add, you know, because I think there are several distinct advantages to defining free will in this way. I mean, first, it provides a neutral definition that virtually all parties can agree to. I mean, you want a definition that doesn't beg the question or exclude various positions from the outset, right? So, you know, one of the things you see quite often in, say, the scientific literature on free will, and even among scientific skeptics about free will, is that they simply define free will in terms of sort of libertarian ability to do otherwise or countercausal, you know, control. And then, you know, by definition, compatibilism is kind of excluded. And likewise, you could define free will in terms of, you know, failure of obstacles or constraints or reasons responsiveness. But what I think it's better to have a definition that all parties can sort of subscribe to at the beginning and leaves open the central question of whether or not we have it. I also think by defining free will in terms of moral responsibility, the definition captures the practical importance of the debate. It anchors the philosophical question in things that are obviously practically and comparatively concrete and, you know, undeniably important to our lives. Things like our moral practices, things like punishment, you know, resentment, indignation, our interpersonal reactions, and our various legal and moral judgments. And then I just add that rejecting this kind of definition, I think, makes it difficult to understand the nature of the substantive disputes between the disputing parties in the free will debate. So, you know, you mentioned I have this book coming out with Dan Dennett. Dan adopts a definition of free will that's connected to responsibility, but his notion of moral responsibility is different than mine. It's what I would call a non-basic desert definition. But one of the problems I find with that definition is that the compatibilist position then is kind of uncontroversial. I mean, all parties can agree to certain sort of consequentialist or forward-looking you know, moral practices, which maybe we could talk about later. But in that case, then, you know, there isn't much room distinguishing the skeptic from the compatibilist. So for the compatibilist thesis to be controversial, to be something worth debating, I think that really what they have to have in mind is something like basic desert.
Yeah, that's great. So some free will skeptics think that free will is impossible, whereas others think that free will is possible, but no one in fact has free will. So how would you characterize your own skeptical position?
My view is that free will is possible. I think agent causal libertarianism, if true, would, you know, provide the kind of control and action required for basic desert moral responsibility. I just think there are good philosophical and scientific reasons for rejecting agent causal libertarianism, i.e. for, you know, sort of concluding that we lack the kind of agency posited by agent causal libertarians, but I don't think the notion is incoherent. You know, it obviously it sort of it may depend on how you interpret possibility talk here. I mean, I think it's conceptually possible to have this kind of free will. I would even think it's metaphysically possible in some possible world agents could have this kind of free will. I just think in our actual world with our actual ways in which the naturalistic laws of nature work, we have good reasons for concluding we don't. But I don't personally see it as a impossible, option.
Yeah. All right. Well, in the first season of the Free Will Show, we discussed arguments for incompatibilism about free will and determinism. So we talked about the consequence argument, the manipulation argument, and we also talked about challenges for the compatibility of free will and indeterminism when we talked about the problem of luck with Al Mealy. We've also talked about the puzzles about moral luck, which is a challenge for any kind of view about moral responsibility for what we do. So these are a lot of arguments, and we can kind of take them one at a time if you want to. But do you think these arguments are successful, or is there some other reason for your skepticism?
Yeah, so my particular arguments for free will skepticism borrow many of the arguments you mentioned. and so maybe I should just lay it out briefly and sure, sketch my view. So, yeah, I mean, it's good that you had this first season so the viewers can go back and listen to the manipulation argument in detail and the luck argument and considerations of moral luck. But my case for free will skepticism kind of features distinct arguments that target the leading rival views. So things like event causal libertarianism, agent causal libertarianism, and compatibilism. And I argue that each of those views fail, but for different reasons. And so as a result, I sort of maintain the skeptical position is the only defensible position left standing. Mm-hmm. And so I view my position as a form of what's called hard incompatibilism. So, I mean, maybe if I were to just take a step back, for those viewers, who might want to hear like a just quick review, is that in the past, the kind of main view for free will skepticism was what was called hard determinism, which is sort of the view that determinism is true. And determinism is the thesis that every event or action, including human action, is sort of the inevitable result of preceding events and actions in combination with the laws of nature. That determinism is true and incompatible with free will, either because it's incompatible with the ability to do otherwise, which was known as leeway incompatibilism, or it's incompatible with the agent being the ultimate source of their actions, which is sometimes referred to as source compatibilism. So there are very few hard compatibilists alive or left. So most of us skeptics are what you might want to call hard incompatibilists. And in this sense, we leave open the possibility the universe may be indeterministic at, the lowest level, maybe a level of quantum mechanics. But we argue that we would lack free will either way. We would lack free will whether or not determinism is true. And so the best way to see it then is to see how the argument unfolds and cuts off all the various options. So for me, against the view that free will is compatible with causal determination of our actions by, say, natural factors beyond our control, i.e. against the view called compatibilism, I argue that there's no relevant difference between that prospect and our actions being causally determined by manipulators. So there I endorse the manipulation argument, which you covered during the first season. And I just want to note that that's a version of what I just referred to as source incompatibilism. So officially, my reason for rejecting compatibilism is a version of source incompatibilism, that determinism is incompatible with agents being the appropriate source of their actions. And then against event causal libertarianism, which posits indeterminism simply at the level of individual events, I object that on those kind of accounts, we're left unable to settle whether a decision occurs, and hence we don't have the control and action required for basic desert. So some people view this as a version of the luck argument, which again you discussed in your first season against event causal libertarians. But I like to put it more in the terms of Dirk Pirabhum's disappearing agent argument, which I guess is a variant of the luck argument, but isn't exactly the same as all versions of the luck argument. So basically the concern is that the agent, quote unquote, sort of disappears at the crucial junction in the production of action, i.e. at exactly the moment when its occurrence is to be settled. Which outcome is going to occur is to be settled. And by settling, I here have in mind a kind of notion where for an agent to settle which option occurs, they have to be able to determine which of those actions occurs, and they have to be able to make a difference to which of those actions occur. And it doesn't seem that the event causal libertarian view allows for that kind of a control and action. And I argue that that's exactly the kind of control and action that would be required for agents to be morally responsible in this basic desert sense. There were other problems with this view too. We could discuss, like, you know, Robert Caine's famous version requires something called dual willings, where you will two different outcomes. I'm not sure that concept is even coherent in my view. It also posits a bunch of empirically questionable requirements. That is, a lot of the event causal libertarians don't necessarily argue that, you know, we have good reason for thinking the world is as their views describe them. Instead, they're giving us a particular account that would make the notion plausible or conceivable. But for the view to even work, assuming it could get even beyond the luck argument, the disappearing agent concern, is indeterminacies would have to be able to percolate up to certain levels within the brain. So for Robert Caine, they would have to reach the level of neural networks. They would have to happen at a very particular temporal moment in time. So there's a lot of empirical constraints that the view posits. And we have no real good reason for thinking that those empirical constraints are actually met. In my view, to continue to engage in certain types of practices that may do potential harm, like blame practices, retributive punishment, on the off chance that all of these requirements are met and that it satisfies the philosophical concerns, would be a kind of moral malpractice, on my view. I think agent causal libertarians could, in theory, I think, supply what's missing from the event causal accounts, i.e. I think they could supply the kind of control that would be needed. But I just argue that they can't be reconciled with our best physical theories about the world. I also think they face additional problems accounting for mental causation. They require, you know, rather controversial sort of metaphysical commitments. So that sort of leads to a version of what's called hard incompatibilism, which is, regardless of whether determinism is true or indeterminism is true, none of the leading accounts would be able to preserve free will. And so the only reasonable position left to adopt, according to people like Dirk Peerboom and myself, is the skeptical view. But unlike Dirk, I've also pushed a version of the hard luck line as well. So Dan Anelkin, I believe, in your first season had an episode on issues having to do with luck.
Yes. Right.
So I present this, and this is not my own view. This is developed by Neil Levy in his very interesting book called Hard Luck, with the title. And hard meaning, again, a view like hard determinism or hard indeterminism, where luck itself, the pervasiveness of luck itself, is incompatible with free will and basic desert. And so the argument is that regardless of whether the universe is deterministic or indeterministic, or however it's causally structured, free will and basic desert would still be incompatible with this pervasiveness of luck. And the core of this concern is something that Neil Levy calls the luck pincer, which basically says either actions are subject to what you can call present luck, which is luck around the time of action. And that can include any indeterminacy in that causal stream that, say, like libertarians posit, but it doesn't have to. It could also include things around the time of action, like what reasons become most salient, what kind of situational effects of the environment might affect your decision making, what kinds of circumstantial factors might influence your choices, or your actions are subject to what you can call constitutive luck, which is the kind of luck in who one is and what character traits and dispositions one has. So these are usually matters of contingencies of birth, things like how you were raised, what family you grew up in, what's your socioeconomic background, all these kind of factors that make you the kind of constitutive individual that you are. And then the argument is that either our actions are the result of present luck, constitutive luck, or both. But either way, luck undermines moral responsibility in this basic desert sense. And so it undermines responsibility level control. And so I sort of argue, and I don't know if anyone else pushes both of those arguments simultaneously, but I've sort of defended in print both the hard luck and the hard indeterminist views. And I sort of say, like, if the right hand doesn't get you, the left hand will, which is defenders of free will, whether compatibilist or libertarian, in my view, need to overcome both sets of arguments, because each is sufficient on its own for establishing free will skepticism.
Thanks. That's a really helpful kind of history of the debate and nice way of laying out your position. So if it's okay now, I think we'll turn to a few common objections to kind of giving up our view of ourselves as free and responsible in the basic desert sense. So maybe the most common, many philosophers claim that it would be a radical revision of our ordinary beliefs and practices to endorse free will skepticism. Right. So what do you take of to be some of the implications of accepting your position, and do you regard them as especially radical?
Well, I'll leave it for others to decide what they want to call it radical. But I'm generally optimistic about the implications of the view. So I've actually, I call or label my view optimistic skepticism because I'm optimistic about the implications of adopting the skeptical perspective. So yeah, I mean, there's a whole host of issues we could talk about here, but I've sort of, and I'm not the only one. I mean, I'm obviously following in the footsteps of people like Dirk Pirrboom and Neil Levy and Bruce Waller, who've also adopt a kind of optimistic skepticism. But I've gone in my work systematically through different domains and looked at what the implications would be, for example, in morality, in criminal law, in even issues having to do with creativity. I wrote a paper on free will skepticism and creativity, on our interpersonal relationships, and argued that in general, we could preserve most of what we care about. So as an optimistic skeptic, basically I argue that the prospects of finding meaning in life or sustaining good interpersonal relationships wouldn't be threatened. We could talk about that. Morality and moral judgments would largely remain intact. Although retributivism and severe punishment, like the death penalty, would have to be ruled out. And so some people may see that as a kind of radical implication. I actually think it's a good thing. And I believe that there are other options like incapacitation, rehabilitation, and different ways of dealing with criminal behavior that would still be justified and I think actually preferable. But maybe we could take some of these one at a time and consider, like, say, interpersonal relationships. Maybe a lot of people have taken sort of the view of P.F. Strawson here and argued, if you were to eradicate free will or to adopt the skeptical perspective, what would that do to what he calls our reactive attitudes, things that are attitudes like resentment and indignation and moral anger, which seem to be really central to our interpersonal relationships? And I would argue, certain types of moral anger, specifically the two I mentioned, resentment, indignation, those would be undercut if free will skepticism were true. But I would argue that those were suboptimal to begin with, from the start, and that there are alternative attitudes that we could adopt that would do just as good in term, would serve just as well in our interpersonal relationships. For example, instead of moral anger, you might feel, sorrow or moral disappointment, and that those kind of attitudes are consistent with the rejection of free will and are able to preserve most of what we care about in terms of our interpersonal exchanges. In terms of morality, that's a hard one. But even if we lack free will, I think we could still say, like, what a serial killer does, even if they're suffering from, say, some brain ailment. By all accounts, this degenerative brain disease would mean they're not morally responsible. I don't think that affects our ability to label the actions as either morally good or morally bad. So free will skeptics would argue that we could preserve what are called axiological judgments, judgments about moral goodness and badness. Those wouldn't be affected. So in general, I think you could preserve most of what you care about in terms of our interpersonal exchanges and our attitudes, most of what we care about when it comes to morality. There's lots of issues we could discuss in there in terms of normative judgments and things like that, which are the stories that maybe a little bit harder on. But I mean, one thing I just want to stress is that basic desert moral responsibility is not the only kind of moral responsibility, right? And so free will skeptics reject only that kind of responsibility, but it leaves intact all these other notions of responsibility. So attributability and answerability, or what Dirk Peerboom calls this kind of forward-looking conversational approach to responsibility. So instead of it being based in backward-looking desert claims, we could, for example, engage in a kind of moral exchange where if someone engages in some kind of immoral behavior, the skeptic could argue that it's perfectly legitimate to engage in some form of moral protest, or to ask the agent, why did you do that? Or, you know, do you think it's the right thing? And if we think their answer is, you know, morally unsatisfying, we could engage in some form of evaluative criticism or moral protest. But the difference in this account would be that on this forward-looking approach to moral responsibility, moral protest and exchange would be grounded not in basic desert, but in particularly three non-basic desert desiderata: future protection, future reconciliation, and future moral formation. Mm-hmm. So like if my daughter does something that I disapprove of, I can engage her in a conversation where she could acknowledge the wrongness of the act, maybe identify some flaw in her own character, for example, and then promise to work moving forward on trying to change that character trait or that disposition. And those kind of exchanges, I would argue, are perfectly legitimate and perfectly available for free will skeptics to embrace, because they're focused not on this backward-looking desert, but on, you know, primarily in my daughter's case, future moral formation. I want her to be a good person. Or future reconciliation. We want to reconcile with the wrongdoer. Or for our own protection, right? We have to instill some sort of moral sensibility in people so, you know, we could protect ourselves in civil society. So I my view is that most of what we care about when it comes to morality, when it comes to meaning in life, when it comes to different approaches to responsibility would be preserved. But yeah, there would be some radical implications in terms of the law and in terms of punishment and the criminal justice system. But maybe we could talk about those separately.
Does your daughter ever pull the line, well, Dad, I'm just not responsible for any of this stuff?
Well, I could say, right, in response that, well, I could attribute to you various characteristics. I could judge the action as wrong, yet what you did was still wrong. And even if you don't deserve blame in this basic desert sense, I could still, you know, we could still analyze the action and move toward some forward-looking, you know, some forward-looking good. I mean, I don't talk to her in those terms, but I mean, I actually think it's an interesting thing, because I think my wife parents more from a retributive approach, and I tend to parent more from the, maybe more consistently with my commitments. I don't know if I'm perfectly consistent.
Yeah. Can we go back to the reactive attitudes for just a second?
Sure.
You mentioned the negative reactive attitudes, and you have, and you, like your view has some plausible alternatives to like indignation. What do you think about the positive, or I don't know if that's the right term, but reactive attitudes like gratefulness and gratitude?
Yeah, so I think there's two things one could say here. I'll say what they could say, and then I'll say what I say. but I think two things are open to the skeptics. So there's a view that has been defended by another free will skeptic, Benjamin Vilhauer, who takes an asymmetric approach towards, say, blame and praise. Let's just use those as, you know, the blame being the negative, praise being the sort of positive reactive attitudes. And he says that since blaming practices can cause harm, we should hold a higher standard for those. And he's a skeptic in a slightly different sense than I am. He's a skeptic in the sense that he thinks we don't know. It's possible we have free will, but we're not in an epistemic position to settle the issue. Mm-hmm. And being in a kind of epistemic uncertainty position, we shouldn't engage in practices that could potentially do harm. But he thinks the positive type of reactive attitudes, maybe like praise, although they can cause harm. I mean, there are senses in which, you know, like every kid gets a trophy and we overpraise our children and maybe they don't learn the lessons they need to, you know, but for the most part, mm-hmm. praising behaviors are innocuous. And so he thinks that they may not stand and fall together. You could actually, perhaps as a skeptic, you know, give a line where we reject the negative reactive attitudes, but we could still hold on to, in some sense, the positive ones because the bar is lower. I think that that line is open. I tend to go, you know, with Dirk Pirrboom here and some others where I think they just stand and fall together. So, although most discussions about moral responsibility period is conducted in terms of the bad reactive attitudes, I would say the same is true for praise. I don't think people deserve praise in this basic sense. But I'm not sure, you know, this is, it may sound radical, but it, I mean, if you look back there's a great interview I found a while back that was conducted with Einstein. It's interesting, like, you know, he was a free will skeptic. He was more of a hard determinist. And so he didn't believe agents were free because he thought determinism excluded free will. And in the interview, he talks about kind of his scientific achievements and says he doesn't deserve praise for any of them. He's very clear about it, too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, people find that relatively odd, but I think if you drill down, it's not that odd of a view. I mean, you know, sometimes when people talk about, say, their good moral character, and if they're being, you know, slightly more reflective about it, or if they're in a conversation in a certain context, they might say, well, you know, thank my mom for that, or thank my upbringing for that. I was raised in the right kind of way. And I do think that we want to say the same for, I think, you know, praise as we want to say for blame, that just like we might not want to blame or hold responsible in the basic sense people who commit criminal acts, on the flip side of that, I would generally think we should also view praising behavior as unjustified when it's, you know, grounded in that purely backward looking sense. So that's my own view, but I do think the asymmetric view is open.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting that there's that difference between two kinds of free will skeptics. I guess Vilhauer is more of a skeptic and you're more of a free will nihilist in that sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. People have taken issue with the term skeptic because many of us skeptics are free will deniers. But I actually like the phrase. I mean, I do think it captures, a class of views, and I think they should go together. So just like epistemic skepticism or skepticism about knowledge, right? There are those who say in any given proposition, we may not be able to determine whether we have knowledge of that, you know, that belief, that fact, that proposition. And that's a kind of like neutrality view, you know, like we just don't know whether in that context we have knowledge. And then there are other more global or radical skeptics that say knowledge is impossible, right? Mm-hmm, And I think the same is true in the free will area, that there are skeptics who argue that in any given situation, we may not be able to determine whether an individual was free. And so we should be kind of epistemic skeptics. And then there are others, and I fall more in this latter camp, where I believe that, you know, who we are and what we do is ultimately a result of factors beyond our control. And because of this, we're never morally responsible in the basic desert sense. Mm-hmm. And those factors beyond our control, as we could see from the earlier arguments we discussed, could include determinism, indeterminism, or luck. But because of any of those three, we would lack the kind of control required. So I tend to be a denier, but I don't mind people who are skeptics in the more general sense of doubters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We've talked about moral responsibility a lot. And you also, your view also has implications when it comes to punishment. In your recent SEP entry on skepticism and moral responsibility, you talk a lot about punishment. So I'm going to read a quotation here from your entry, and it's an objection that you address in the SEP entry. One last practical concern about moral responsibility skepticism is that it is unable to adequately deal with criminal behavior and that the responses it would permit are, as justified, are insufficient for acceptable social policy. This concern is fueled by two factors. The first is that one of the most prominent justifications for punishing criminals, retributivism, is incompatible with moral responsibility skepticism. The second concern is that alternative justifications that are not ruled out by the skeptical view per se face independent moral objections. Critics contend that these moral objections are decisive. Skeptics about moral responsibility, on the other hand, argue that non-retributivist alternatives exist that are both ethically defensible and practically workable. Could you say a little bit more about this worry and explain how you respond?
Yeah, so that's a big one. So yeah, I mean, when retributive, so in terms of context of punishment, for example, in the criminal justice system, one of the leading justifications for legal punishment, both historically and currently, is what we could call retributive punishment. And so the retributive justification for legal punishment maintains that absent any excusing conditions like insanity defenses or some condition that might excuse the wrongdoer, wrongdoers are in general morally responsible for their actions and deserve to be punished in proportion to their wrongdoing. So retributivists ground their justification, and I would say sort of two things: backward looking. It's a backward looking justification, and it's grounded in the notion of just desserts. The individual needs to be given their just desserts, and you know, not desserts or or what we eat after dinner, but dessert in the sense of like basic dessert. So unlike theories of punishment that aim at, say, like deterrence or incapacitation or rehabilitation, retributivists ground punishment in the blameworthiness and desert of offenders. So if free will skeptics are correct, then one of the leading justifications for punishment is off the table, because the free will skeptic says no one deserves punishment. Not just the criminal, but no one really is deserving in the basic desert sense. And it's exactly the basic desert sense that retributivism needs. And that's made clear by a number of retributivists. I'll just give you one classic thought experiment that Immanuel Kant used. So Kant was a retributivist, and he has a very famous example that many people probably have read about the desert island society. So he imagines this desert island. Society is going to disband and all its members are going to scatter around the world. And there's one remaining prisoner in jail, and it's a murderer. And he says, he asks, would it be morally justified to execute that last prisoner before you leave the island? Now, Kant also believed in the death penalty. So Kant says that not only would you be justified, you'd be required to execute that person before you left the island. And think about how purely backward looking this is, right? There's no one left to deter, so you're not punishing this person to deter future crime. You're not punishing this person to help in their moral development, because you're killing them. It's not to keep anyone safe. There's no one left to keep safe. It's purely backward-looking desert, right? And so that's the kind of basic desert that the skeptic denies. So if skeptics are right, then retributive justification is unsound. And so that's a major part of the criminal justice system that would need to be revised. But there are other justifications for punishment that are consistent with the skeptical view. And so one of the more famous ones is a kind of consequentialist deterrence-based approach. And so that's forward-looking. So you might say, why punish this individual? One reason is they deserve it, backward-looking. Another reason you could say we should punish this individual is because it will deter other would-be criminals or help in their moral formation. Those are forward-looking reasons. But the problem with some of those forward-looking justifications is, although they're consistent with free will skepticism, they suffer from other powerful moral objections. So like one problem with deterrence-based justifications is that they may seem capable of justifying punishing innocent people or coming down excessively harsh on one individual, let's say, if it were successfully deter other criminals. So let's say there's a petty crime spree. And each petty crime isn't very significant in itself, but collectively it's doing a whole lot of damage to society. And let's just say, hypothetically, we could effectively prevent and deter all would petty criminals if we just gave this one petty criminal life in prison. Deterrence-based consequentialist views would have a hard time explaining why that would be a bad thing. Whereas I think most intuitively, we think that that's an excessively harsh punishment for for such an insignificant or small crime. And so these, I won't go through all of them, but there are all these kind of moral objections. There's the use objection, which is just kind of an objection that most people are familiar with for utilitarianism in general, which is that the view may allow us to use certain people as a means to an end. So one classic example of that is three strikes, you're outlaws. Those were largely implemented in the United States, not for retributivist reasons, but for consequentialist reasons. I mean, the idea was that, you know, if you put someone in prison for life for three felonies, this would deter would-be felons. But it's led to, it's contributed significantly to mass incarceration. But it also, it has all these, you know, practical negative effects. But beyond those, it also suffers, I think, from a kind of use objection, which is, think of like the problem of evil in a way where you know, say we have this trouble of, you know, justifying why an all loving, all knowing, all good God would allow, you know, good people to suffer. And there's this baby that's born, an innocent child, and it has Tay-Sachs disease, which is a genetic disorder. And it means that it's going to live a life of nothing but pain and suffering and die before it's, you know, four or five, as all children with Tay-Sachs ultimately do. And you might say, well, why would, you know, God allow that? And you might give reasons, you know, theodicies or attempts to explain this. And you might say, well, it's to test the faith of others, or to test the perseverance of the parents, or to test the goodwill of society, all these possible goods that could come of it. But that runs afoul of what I might call the Jack and Jill problem, which is like you beat the hell out of Jack to teach Jill a lesson. It doesn't explain Jack, i.e. it doesn't explain, you know, why Jack has to suffer for the good of Jill. Well, the same with the three strikes you're outlaws. Let's say they do effectively deter, just hypothetically. There have been people, and I document a case in my book where this guy in California was given life in prison for essentially stealing about $30 worth of VHS tapes from Walmart. And it's because he was convicted of two felonies in these two cases of theft, but he had a prior conviction. And in California, two crimes with a prior felony conviction entails life in prison. But let's say it did deter other would-be felons. I would say that that's an illegitimate use of this individual. Right, this individual is being sacrificed as a means to some further end. So, if you reject these alternative views, then that really is a problem, and that's the kind of quote you read from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy entry. That if you reject retributivism and these other views suffer from all these moral problems, where does that leave us? And the focus of a lot of my recent work is to develop an alternative to that avoids both retributivism, but also the moral failures of these other views.
Great. If you wouldn't mind, could we ask you to say a little bit about your alternative to the retributivist and the deterrent, you know, justifications for punishment?
Yeah, sure. So it's called the public health quarantine model, and it begins with a analogy first developed by Dirk Pirrboom. And then I placed that within the larger context of public health, the public health framework, and public health approaches to crime in general. Mm-hmm. But I'll just give you the sort of nuts and bolts of it. So it begins with a comparison with quarantine. So you think of like, so you could kind of present this as a quick little three premise argument. Free will skeptics claim that criminals are not morally responsible for their actions in the basic desert sense. And that's simply because, right, nobody is. Mm-hmm. Well, premise two, you know, mainly carriers of dangerous diseases are not responsible in this or any other sense for having contracted these diseases. So let's say I get on a plane to come visit you guys in person, and somehow I contract Ebola, and they test me when I get off the plane. I haven't done anything morally wrong. Retribution or retributive punishment seems unjust in this context. And yet, I think we'd all agree that we are morally justified in quarantining this individual for the safety of society. So the justification for quarantining this individual would not be deterrence. It would not be retributive punishment. In fact, you don't need to appeal to free will or moral responsibility at all to justify quarantining this individual. Instead, the justification for quarantine would be grounded in some sort of a right of self-defense and protection of harm to others. So we quarantine this individual on the grounds that we must do so to protect public health, i.e. to prevent a pandemic, let's say. It's interesting when we first developed this view, most people didn't have a familiarity with public health or with the notion of quarantine. And so everyone now has some lived experience with these kinds of justification. Yeah. So I don't know if that makes my view more appealing or less. We'll see. But in general, the idea would be that you could also provide an incapacitation account for why we are justified incapacitating, say, serial killers or child molesters on a grounds analogous to quarantine, i.e. it'd be an incapacitation account grounded in the right of self-defense and protection of harm to others, analogous to the justification you would use, say, for quarantining someone with a communicable disease. Mm-hmm. But there's a number of really important implications with this view. One is that as less dangerous diseases, justify only preventative measures less restrictive than quarantine, less dangerous criminal tendencies would justify only more moderate restraints, meaning we don't quarantine people for the common cold, mm-hmm. right? I pose a risk out there if I'm sick, and if I sneeze on you and you get sick, that causes you some harm, but we accept a certain amount of risk as acceptable risk within society. And we restrict quarantine to very prescribed, very special cases. And so this would be consistent with what we call the principle of least infringement, which argues that you would have to adopt the least restrictive measures possible to protect public safety. And in most cases, there are measures short of incapacitation that are available within the criminal justice system. So my view is consistent with the decriminalization of a lot of things we currently incarcerate people for. It's consistent with alternative measures like supervision or less invasive ways to protect society. Second, if you were to hold me at the airport because I have Ebola, the story doesn't end there. You have a moral duty to treat me with the quarantine analogy and then release me the minute I'm no longer a threat to society, because your justification for limiting my liberty evaporates the minute I'm no longer a public health threat. And so on my view, the criminal justice system then would have to consider the well-being of those we incapacitate. And the focus of the criminal justice system then would have to shift from a punitive system, one that doles out punishments, to one that aims at rehabilitation and reintegration. Mm-hmm. And the minute that individual is no longer a threat to society, we no longer have grounds for limiting their liberty. I also would think, in the book, I argue that this is not only a non-retributive approach to crime, I also view it as a non-punitive approach to crime, because now this gets semantic to some extent, but the literature on punishment and legal punishment in particular requires that a certain number of conditions be met. So when we punish individuals, not only do we usually cause them harm or reduce their well-being in some way, right? It involves intentional harm. So when the state doles out legal punishment, it is intentionally imposing some sort of penalty on an individual, some sort of harsh treatment. Now, it doesn't have to be physical harsh treatment. It might just be a deprivation of liberty or a fine, but it's a reduction in overall well-being. And so punishment involves intentionally harming individuals. It also usually involves the state communicating disapproval. So it's a communicative component. This approach the public health quarantine model doesn't preserve any of that. There's a difference between what I would call foreseeable harm and intentional harm. And there's a difference between using someone as a, say, means to an end and what we might call preventative harming. So when I quarantine the individual with Ebola, I am limiting their liberty. But I don't think that we are punishing them in any intuitive sense of the definition of punishment. Right. No one really. I think if you get drill down into it, no one really thinks of that as punishment. Just like if I trip and knock over an elderly person and cause them harm, I haven't punished them, right? Because punishing requires more than just harming them. It includes some kind of intentional harm imposed on them for some perceived wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. None of that is really happening here. So the fact that it's not punitive has a number of really important ripple effects in terms of policy. So, you know, the institutions in which we incapacitate people for example, would have to shift from the kind of punitive approaches of prison design that we currently have, because prisons in the United States and the UK and Australia are punitive places. You know, they're designed for punitive purposes. Instead, I've even written about the architectural nature of how we would build these institutions for the purposes of rehabilitation. And they would intentionally have to be built for non-punitive, you know, reasons, i.e. for rehabilitative and reintegrative reasons. And that would mean the way we treat individuals, the kind of freedoms they would have within the institution would all have to drastically be altered. And a number of other policy implications that I spell out in detail in the book. But that's the basic idea. And then just one additional thing I'll add to this, which in my view is the main thing, and unfortunately I don't have a lot of time to talk about, is, yeah, I owe you a story of what to do with, you know, the serial killer. And so I give you this story, this incapacitative account grounded in the right of self-defense, analogous to quarantine. But I really want to shift the discussion from the myopic focus on punishment and move it to a sort of preventive approach. And so one of the things the public health framework allows us to do is reorient things away from the myopic focus on what to do in terms of punishment on the tail end, and shifts it to what I call prevention and social justice. And public health has a long track record and a number of methodologies that are really well developed for these purposes. So one of the things I argue, for instance, is the social determinants of poor health are essentially analogous to the social determinants of criminal behavior. Poor health outcomes are often the result of poverty. We know, like, for example, people in low economic, what are called low SES environments, socioeconomic status, tend to have higher rates of type 2 diabetes and higher rates of morbidity and heart disease. If you want to address that public health outcome, i.e. the poor health, you have to address those social inequities. And we also know that poverty drives incarceration rates. We know that exposure to violence in the home affects poor health, but also affects incarceration rates. And so there are a number of social determinants I identify, things like poverty, abuse, housing, mental illness, healthcare, education, nutrition, environmental health, et cetera, that not only affect health outcomes, but affect criminality and violent behavior. And so we should adopt a public health approach that looks at those, identifies them, prioritizes them, and then targets them. And so the social justice aspect comes in the aspect where you have to address certain social inequities if you want to redress those poor health outcomes. So like if you look at infant mortality rates, for example, of children in third world nations, you'll see that, you know, they're much worse off than in, say, developed countries like the United States. And when you look at the reasons why, a lot of the times those high infant mortality rates are due to things like women's rights. Women don't have reproductive control over their bodies. They don't have access to birth control. And so to address that poor health outcome, you have to address the social injustice, the sexist norms of the society. And so on my view, and I think this is a benefit of my view, we can't successfully address criminal justice without simultaneously addressing issues of social justice. And so the public health framework provides us with ways and mechanisms and tools. And I spell out a whole bunch of ways in which we could adopt public health approaches and implement them in effective ways. But the goal for me is to move away from the reactive approach to a proactive approach.
Great. Well, this is fascinating. Thanks so much for joining us, Greg. I'm sure many of our listeners will be interested in following your work. So where would you guide our listeners to go if they want to follow what you're working on?
Yeah, I guess two places. One is my website, which is just www.gregcaruso.com. And I spell my name G-R-E-G-G. CARUSO. So you could look me up there or follow me on Twitter, which is at Greg D. Caruso. And I usually announce things like books and articles. So you can find them on either of those places.
Great.
All right. Yeah. Thanks again for being with us. In our next episode, we're going to be turning to compatibilist positions on free will. And our guest is going to be Helen Beebe, Samuel Hall Professor of Philosophy at the University of Manchester.